You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Remember, send me a text, 2057, particularly on our next topic, because we'd love to have some questions from you, or send me an email, inbox@realitycheck.radio. I'll be upset if you don't, and so too will Tane, because it's our session for Politics Explained, Back to Basics in the Political Sandpit. Good morning, Tane.
Good morning, Rodney. How you going?
Oh, so good. You know, you make me go back years and years and years because you asked me political questions, and I got to sort of stop and think a little bit because for me it's a long time ago, and when I walked out of Parliament, I never looked back. And funny enough, it was only the COVID rules that got me back anxious about politics again. So it's very nice because you take me back to what I see is another life. So far away, what have we got this week?
Right, so this week we've got two questions because the first one is something we've kind of already covered a little bit and we should be able to wrap it up pretty quickly. And the second one is a little bit more controversial. So the first one is, how would you explain to someone voting for the first time this year the difference between the party vote and the electorate vote, and what factors should they take into consideration when making those decisions?
Yeah. Well, politically, and to whom forms the government, the only vote that counts is the party vote. So from a party's perspective, they are totally indifferent about the electorate vote. They do not care. And in a funny way, they get upset if seats they don't expect to win, they win. Because what that means, they actually gain an MP that they didn't particularly want in Parliament that wasn't high on their list, and they lose someone on their list that they wanted into Parliament. So from a party perspective, it's only the party vote that matters. It's hard to believe, because when you go from first past the post, the only vote that counts, of course, is your electorate vote for your local MP. And when you're sitting there, you think it's a big deal, your electorate vote, but it's not. Essentially, the MPs a party are entitled to is determined by their party vote. What the electorate vote determines is the composition of those MPs. So, for example, let's imagine that you get X percent of party votes and you're entitled to 20 MPs. Well, you'll get your 20 MPs if you get no electorate MPs. If you get 10 electorate MPs, you'll still only get 20 MPs. You'll get 10 electorate MPs and then 10 off your list. If you get 20 electorate MPs, that's all you'll get. And so it's the party vote that determines the strength of your position in Parliament and who gets to form the government. There's one exception to the rule, and the exception is parties like the Maori Party, the Green Party, and the ACT Party, and potentially other smaller parties, because they face a hurdle of getting 5% of the party vote. Now, if they win their seat, if they win an electorate seat, that hurdle is broken. So they'll get, if they got, I'll use me as an example. In 2005, we were facing oblivion. And I made the claim that if you vote for me, not only would you get me as your electorate MP, you'd still get Richard Wirth, who was standing for National, because he would come in on their list. Plus, you'd get two or three other ACT MPs. So you could give your electorate vote to the National guy and get one MP, or vote for me and you get four, five, or six MPs. And that's true, as bizarre as it sounds, and it took me a great deal of convincing of voters that the smart thing to do was to give their electorate vote to me. And indeed, I succeeded, and Richard Wirth still got into Parliament. I made it to Parliament. The ACT Party made it to Parliament, and we had three or four, I can't remember, maybe two MPs. Two MPs. And so two MPs were working towards Ipsum. So they actually had three MPs in a funny way. And then in 2008, we're able to get more MPs. So for the smaller parties, the electorate vote is a strategic vote. So what should you think about? Well, under MMP, you should give your party vote to the party whose policies you most like, full stop, as long as you think they're going to be in parliament. And that becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you give your vote to a party that doesn't make it to parliament, in a sense, you'll feel a bit cheated. You might give them some comfort and people might notice what they were saying, but I doubt it. The world, the New Zealand is littered with the carcasses of failed political parties. So the party vote is to the party whose policies you best like that's going to make it into parliament. And for your electorate vote, you want to vote for the person who you think would best serve you as a constituent. And that might be the one that's already there because you've had some interaction with them. And it's always quite good if you can go and see your MP and remind them that you voted for them. It means that they'll listen to you.
Yeah. I had actually a follow-up that we hadn't planned to cover, but is there something to do with, in terms of inside a political party structure, how an MP is treated if they're a list or an electorate MP? Like if they're a list MP, they can kind of get rid of them, right? But if they're an electorate MP,
Yes. I mean, there are great examples of Labour MPs. George Hawkins was one. I'm thinking of the other name. And under MMP, they were sort of conservative MPs. And Helen Clark hated their politics, didn't want them in. But they had very strong electorate organisations and she couldn't get rid of them. And so, yes, electorate MPs are very powerful within the caucus because if they've got a secure base, they can't be disciplined. They can be shoved down the list, but they'll still get in. What they'll do, and we've seen this in recent times too, where MPs have effectively been had their electorate candidacy contested and lost because the party machine is kicked in behind them. So within the party structure, it does matter. And of course, within the ACT Party, David Seymour is very powerful. Not only is he leader, but he holds the only seat, which means he breaks the 5% threshold. So he's got more power than most leaders as a consequence. I should say that your behaviour changes. I was a list MP for several terms, and then I became a constituent MP. And I felt the difference immediately, because when you're a list MP, it's sort of abstract who your voters are. You know, you're a 5% party or a 10% party or even a 40% party. You don't particularly meet your voters. They are sort of anonymous to you. But when you have an electorate, when you have this geographical place that you represent, you feel driven to be the best MP that I could for this area, because these people had put their trust in you, and that affects you deeply. And then when you walk down the street, you're saying hello to the people who voted for you or who you would like to vote for you. You don't get that with as a list MP, and being an electorate MP makes you humble and it makes you more conservative because you're aware of the wide range of views that exist in your electorate. Big difference.
Well answered. Shall we move on to question two?
Yes, please.
Sure. So the next one is, why do rural areas tend to vote right wing and big cities tend to vote left wing? And this is not just the New Zealand question. I'm sure you're aware, it occurs in Australia, the United States, and so on and so forth.
Well, the people typically, and we're talking, in general, so it's not a specific example, but in general, If you live in a provincial area in New Zealand or a rural area in New Zealand, you are typically a producer. You're making things, you're growing things, or you're helping those that do. And you're very, very conscious of production. I grew up in a provincial town. My father was a truck driver. And our whole world revolved around things being built, things being grown, things being transported, motors being fixed, and work being done. And things that made it easier to get work done was a good thing, and things that got in the way were a bad thing. When I went on to become a university lecturer and live in a city, you become detached from production and you become more conscious of distribution. And there you have it, the difference between a socialist outlook and a capitalist one. Because if you're working as an accountant or a lawyer or a university lecturer or a teacher, you become less aware of production and more aware of numbers on a spreadsheet or something like that and its distribution. There's another difference, and that is if you live in a rural provincial part, you learn to back yourself and to trust yourself in order to get things done, because you have to. If you're a truck driver and your truck breaks down, you got to figure out what to do. And so you become more resilient and you appreciate resilience in others and you appreciate resilience in yourself and you don't like dependency. When you live in a city, you are very conscious that it's sort of a bit arbitrary even keeping your job, if you know what I mean. You're working for some faceless organization where you never even meet the boss, and you become insecure and you're conscious of your interdependency, and you're conscious that if the supermarket doesn't have food, you're going to starve. Whereas if you're in town, you'll go out and kill a sheep and eat that. So you become a more dependent person and less aware of production. You become more interested in having a safety net than backing yourself to look after yourself. And there's a third feature, I think, and this is, pretty speculation, but polling tends to suggest this, that if you're involved with your hands and production, you're humble and you're very conscious of experience and what experience teaches you. And you respect older people that have done the job many years, because you go fencing and there's an old time fencer and you're a new time fencer and you think you're hot stuff, you're going to hit a problem and you're going to think, oh, I don't know what to do here. And then the old guy will come along and he'll tell you what to do. And what that means is you're very conscious of what has gone on before. And so you're conservative. You respect institutions. You find yourself doing things because that's how granddad did it, and he would have done it for a reason. When you live in a city, it's very easy to be arrogant, and it's very easy to blame others. And if you're working in an office, it's a great example, because you can strut around an office being king of the heap, and being able to shift blame, not take responsibility. We've all seen this working in a large organization and an office. And it comes with a hubris. You think you're good at your job and therefore you're good at everything. And you start to think that you can make the world a better place because you're so clever. And then the next thing that happens, it's automatic, is you start looking down your nose at provincial people, the deplorables, the rivers of filth, because they aren't successful like you, when in fact you're just full of hubris. And time and time and time and time again, how often have we seen university professors, legal experts, political consultants, and they pontificate about what everyone else should be doing? Whereas a typical provincial person are doing what they're doing, trying to do their best, conscious they often get it wrong, and have humility. They wouldn't think to be telling other people what to do. Takes a university professor who does nothing to do that.
Yeah.
The difference in some between the cities voting left and the provincial and rural areas voting centre-right.
Yeah, the first time I noticed it was in a graph that had been circulating online of the 2016 or 2020 United States election, which showed by county, red and blue, Republican versus Democrat, extremely obvious. If you look that up, you'll see it. I thought of a few extra points to make. What do you? I mean, the funny thing is, though, they've got this plan to herd us into smart cities. So as people are moving into these smart cities, that's going to basically mean more left-wing culture, left-wing voters, theoretically.
Oh, of course. The entire apparatus of government, the entire function of Westminster, of Washington, D.C., and of Wellington is to tell the rest of us what to do and to make us utterly dependent upon them. Why? Because they're the philosopher kings. They're Plato's philosopher kings. They've been to university. They've got PhDs. They've done degrees in sociology. They know they are experts. And so every policy that's formulated is always formulated with the goal of giving Wellington or Washington or Westminster more power and making the people more dependent. And as you give Washington and Wellington and London more power, and as you make the people more dependent, the vote shifts from centre-right to centre-left because people lose confidence in themselves. And so things that we used to do ourselves with our families and our community, we now rely on government to do for us. And it's a long, long list. We can no longer educate our kids or bring them up or even care for them. We can no longer build a house because, you know, we wouldn't know what to do. We need government to advise us. We have a view that people can't look after themselves, and so government will do it for them. It's the most extraordinary thing. It was brought home to me very dramatically as a minister one time, one particular moment, when after the Christchurch earthquake, I was, half the schools were out, and I was advocating that we just fund the students and they could find their own school with their parents' help. It might be, you know, they go to Christ College because it wasn't badly hit, or they actually go to a hall and teachers there congregate and start teaching. And I was getting great enthusiasm of this from my National Party colleagues. And the Ministry of Education was pushing back very, very hard with all these objections, which I was able to bat off very easily. And then finally, it came to a crunch point, and the Ministry of Education said to myself and my cabinet colleagues, but this would mean parents would choose for themselves which school their kids go to.
Can't have that.
Can't have that. And you know the shocking thing? The national ministers all said, oh, no, gosh, we couldn't do that. And that brought it home to me. Fundamentally, that's what it is. And, of course, they can always point to the case where someone made their own choice for themselves and it turned out bad. It was a mistake. And so because you can make mistakes, it's better that government does it for you. But, of course, government is just one enormous mistake without anything to compare it to, because it doesn't allow the comparison. It's monolithic. And, of course, we would get a far better outcome if we funded students to go to the school of their choice, whether it's private, public, or whatever. than actually having a top-down system that says, here's your local school, go to it, and everything will be decided in a combination between the teachers and the ministry and the politicians and parents, and their kids' needs don't count.
The other point I thought I'd make is that rural people who live in generally rural areas are on average going to be more connected to the land, to nature, and so their views and beliefs are going to be more lined up with nature. And yes. Then and the people in the cities are more on average subjected to the regime propaganda. And yeah. The regime propaganda is for more of what we would define generally as quote-unquote leftist ideologies.
It's very disconnected. I tell you, the great example of that to me was the River of Filth and the parliamentary protest, because there's been protests on Parliament forever and a day, but they've all always been wanky, and that they'd turn up if it was fine, and if it started to rain, they'd rush home. And they'd stay there for a couple of hours and do a performative protest and, you know, in the modern era, take selfies or get their picture taken by the TV and the Wellington News, and then disappear, job done. But that River of Filth, that was actually people that don't normally protest. That was provincial New Zealand. And in the cities, of course, there are effective provincial people who are tradespeople, and they turned up. And they weren't going home. They didn't care that it rained. They didn't care that Trevor, I've forgotten his name.
Mallard
turned the sprinklers on and played loud music. They reveled in those sort of little problems, and they were capable. They could cook. They could get food into the parliamentary grounds. They could plumb toilets. They could organise their own security. The organisation and the spontaneity and their ability to look after themselves and others, that's what shocked Parliament. Because the Parliament, the MPs and the journalists, they couldn't do any of that. They're useless. They actually can't look after themselves. I know, I've been one. I mean, I couldn't look after myself. I had to come out of Parliament and start again, like I'd just left school, and teach myself to be able to look after myself. I loved it because I've always appreciated that. And, you know, now I can grow food, thanks to Wally. I can fix cars, thanks to having an old dunger. I can cook.
Making bread.
I make bread because I've taught myself. But if you're, when I was a minister and an MP, when I left Parliament, I didn't know how to book a flight. The first flight I had to make, I didn't know how you book a flight on Air New Zealand. I'd never done it. Isn't that extraordinary?
That's extraordinary.
I'm embarrassed to admit that now.
No,
leave it in. It's so fantastic. It's so funny, right? Because, you know, I was looking and I was scratching my head. I used to fly several times a week, and yet I'd never book tickets.
Crazy.
And so when the parliamentarian saw provincial New Zealand, and I'm using that, there was a lot of provincial New Zealand, you know, we saw those farmers turn up with the hay, you know, and walking amongst them carrying more hay in each hand than a small ute could put on the back. You know, these guys just walked in with this hay looking so knowing what to do. And outsmarting the politicians, that shook. I know that would have shooken me if I was in Parliament, because you're thinking, these guys and these girls, they aren't going home. And there's nothing we can do to them to shift them, because they're better than us. And they had to end that protest, because having declared them all trespassers, every minute that protest lasted, it was a message to the rest of New Zealand that the laws that they make only work because we follow them. And if we choose to ignore them, they no longer work. It was a scary moment for our parliament and our government mandarins, because they were in danger of literally losing the country and losing all authority, because you're standing there saying, you know, little tin pot Caesar saying, go home, and say, no. What do you do?
Yeah, yeah. It's a good note to wrap it up on.
Thank you, Tane. Well, that was Politics Explained, Back to the Basics in the Political Sandpit with my young friend, Tane Webster, who's like a muse to me because he asks me these questions and he gets me thinking about politics again. You're on Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. It's Reality Check Radio. Please send me a text, 2057. Send a text for Tane to ask and for me to try and answer. If I've got it wrong and you've got a different view, send me a text, tell me, or send me an email at inbox@realitycheck.radio. Thank you so much for listening, and Tane will be back next week.
Yep,